This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening here on the solstice, longest day of the year in the Northern Hemisphere anyway. And for all of our listeners in Tierra del Fuego and Antarctica, let our podcast get you through the winter. We'll deal with the summer up here. And what are we dealing with this hour? We're going to be talking about the Farm Bill. I knew you'd be excited about that, but actually that's the reaction to the Miami Heat beating the San Antonio Spurs in Game 7 of the NBA Finals, second championship for LeBron James. And speaking of Kings, later this hour we'll mark the 50-year anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, language he tried out first in a speech delivered in Detroit, which turned out to be a warm-up for the Washington, D.C. dream speech we know today. Plus, the dreams of undocumented immigrants recounted in a new film.
There's thousands of other stories like mine. And again, we're here. We want to be taxpaying citizens. We are taxpaying people.
That's Jose Antonio Vargas in the film Documented, which opens today. But we begin this hour noting that yesterday was the official United Nations Day of Refugees, which the UN noted with numbers reported to be the highest in 20 years. 45 million displaced people in 2012, an estimated 7.6 million people newly displaced last year, including more than a quarter of the population of Syria.
10 million people will be in desperate need of food, shelter, and assistance. So the lives of millions of people are in your hands, and you must find common ground.
That's actress Angelina Jolie speaking there as a representative for the United Nations at a refugee camp in Jordan. Joining us now is Megan Bradley, a fellow at the Joint Brookings London School of Economics Project on Internal Displacement. Megan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So give us a sense of the scale. I said at the top of the hour that the biggest city in the world is a tent city of 45 million, if you count all of the displaced people. Of course, they're dispersed around the world. Give me a bit of a breakdown of that 45 million, if you could.
Sure. Well, the past year has been a really horrible one for the displacement of human beings due to conflict and persecution. We've seen in the past year an increase of almost 3 million in the number of people who are displaced around the world, so that now we have a total of 15.4 million people who are registered as refugees by the United Nations, and a total of 28.8 million people who are on the record as having been displaced within their own countries as a result of conflict and human rights violations.
The internal displacement seems to be a bigger story almost, and that comes from various kinds of reasons, everything from war to climate change.
That's true. So these are individuals who are often in a situation that's very much like refugees, but because they haven't crossed an international border, oftentimes we don't hear much about them in the media. It can be very difficult for humanitarian agencies and UN organizations to reach them with assistance. So ultimately, their governments are responsible for providing them with human rights protection and with the assistance that they often need to save their lives, in fact. But it's often the governments who are really responsible for their displacement in the first place. So it can be quite a paradoxical situation.
Well, it's a horror show. I mean, is it the case that the people in Congo, for instance, one of the largest populations of internally displaced, are out of the reach of the United Nations or the international community at large?
Well, some of them are being reached by NGOs and UN agencies, but many are out of reach. This is also a massive problem in Syria at the moment. So we hear quite a bit about the 1.6 million Syrian refugees who are in neighboring countries like Jordan and Lebanon, but we hear much less, really, about the 4.25 million who are displaced within their own country. And many of these individuals are out of the reach of humanitarian organizations, and their government is certainly not coming through on its responsibility towards them. In many cases, obviously, the government is actively persecuting its own citizens.
The situation in Mali is a pretty horrible combination of religious sectarian violence and a massive drought, I mean, climate issues.
Mm-hmm. The situation in Mali, I think, is indicative of what we can expect to see more of in future years, this really complex intersection of individuals who are on the move because of conflict that's linked to the effects of climate change, natural disasters like drought.
Has technology helped in this situation, maintaining communication? You know, people bring cell phones with them. I mean, it used to be the case that, people would leave their homes with their pictures, and that would be about it, and anything else that they could carry. But now you've got people coming into refugee camps, able to communicate if you could just get a wireless network up.
In some cases, that is true, but we often also see that people are fleeing with nothing more than the clothes that they have on their back. So it's a possibility for some who have the benefit of that access to technology, but there are still so many who are really not in that situation yet.
Do we design well for refugee settlements? And do we understand that sometimes these places will have to be a home for people for a matter of years?
I would say that we are coming to understand better and better what the principles might be for designing settlements for refugees and IDPs, but often they're not applied in practice. I'd also stress that the vast majority of people who are displaced around the world today are actually not living in camps. They're not living in settlements that have been specifically designed for them. They're living in cities intermixed with the local population. This is the case, for example, with both IDPs, internally displaced persons, and refugees from Syria. The vast majority are living in apartments that they've rented, or they're living in shacks that they've built. They're staying with host families. It's only a minority who are actually living in formal camps. Those who are living in formal camps are often the poorest of the poor. And because these camps are constructed rapidly and with the idea that a clear signal needs to be sent that these are not permanent settlements, the infrastructure that's available is often really inadequate.
Megan Bradley is a fellow at the Joint Brookings London School of Economics Project on Internal Displacement. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So on Capitol Hill yesterday, it was the simple doctrine of just say no.
The yeas are 195, the nays are 234. The bill has not passed.
I told you we were going to talk about the farm bill, the 2013 farm bill. That's the sound of all $940 billion worth of it going down to defeat yesterday in the House of Representatives. As usual, there were lots of goodies on the menu. Farm bills are typically full of much-beloved subsidies on everything from ethanol to ice cream. This bill also intended to cut $20.5 billion from the huge food stamp program, but nothing was enough to draw that elusive majority in the House. The Takeaway's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us from Washington, D.C. Todd, welcome back.
Hi, John.
So was this ideological division in the House or just House dysfunction?
What a legislative mess. It was both. You had Republicans, John, conservative Republicans, who, as you would expect, were really uncomfortable voting for a nearly trillion-dollar bill. Just too much spending. Hey, John Boehner's one of them. In his entire career, he's never voted for a farm bill because he considers it overladen with special favors and subsidies and special interest perks. Well, John Boehner, the speaker, said he was going to vote for this farm bill because he knew that he had to give it some imprimatur to get it passed. But then there were lots and lots of different touch points. Forget about Democrats, just among Republicans. The cost of the bill, subsidies for different programs, nutritional programs, including food stamps. What had happened over several weeks is that Republicans and Democrats on the Agriculture Committee had put together a pretty elegant deal to make sure this bill could pass. They knew they had to cut spending in this bill because of the debt and deficit, and Republicans are going to insist on cutting spending. Great, everybody got that. The biggest part of this bill is nutritional assistance and food stamps. There's lots of different kinds of nutritional assistance in the bill. It's the bulk of the bill. But food stamps, John, 47 million Americans get some form of food stamp assistance at some point during the year. It's a massive program. Republicans want to cut that. Democrats don't. But they reached an agreement to do some cuts as long as you didn't touch other parts of it. The bill got to the floor and looked like there was going to be a fragile coalition to go ahead and pass it. Of course, most Democrats aren't going to vote for $21 billion in cuts to food stamps, but they got some other stuff that they thought they might be able to support. Then, John, at the last minute, here's what happened. Republican votes started to head for the exits, and Eric Cantor and John Boehner started to put some amendments on the floor to get Republicans back. Hey, we'll switch around the dairy subsidy program to get more Republicans on board. They did that, but then Democrats bolted. Hey, we'll add some new requirements to food stamps, things like new work requirements, new tracking, make it a little bit harder to get food stamps and actually shave some of the benefits in some states. Republicans came on board, Democrats bolted. Huh. So this fragile coalition to put together the bill, it just fell apart. And in the end, some 40 Democrats who were going to vote for this fragile deal, half of them said no way. The bill failed on the floor. It was a disaster.
So really, this is the Democrats shooting it down in the end. And you can hear the dysfunction in how you're describing the story there. Cantor and the leadership are essentially trying to do on the floor of the House what would normally have been done in committee, right?
it was done in committee, and in the end, it wasn't enough. And there is a lot of blame and recriminations over whose fault this was. Of course, Republicans did say and would say, Nancy Pelosi, you guys promised us 40 votes and you delivered 20. That's why it failed. Nancy Pelosi will turn around and say, if you guys can't pass a bill and 62 of your own members voted against it, what do you want from me?
Well, here's Nancy Pelosi responding to that point.
But it's always interesting to me when people blame other people for their own failures. If we ever came to you when we had the majority and said we didn't pass a bill because we didn't get enough Republican votes, well, you know, it's silly. It's sad. It's juvenile. It's unprofessional. It's amateur hour.
Wow. And here's Ted Yoho, a Republican from Florida, saying it was no big deal what we were trying to do with food stamps.
We simply closed the loopholes that allow states to sign people up into programs without the proper qualifications.
So what's the spirit like there on the floor? Is it just sort of bipartisan nan-na-na-na-na? Or is there a sense of alarm that things are really non-functional on a pretty critical and normally not controversial bill?
There was a little bit of both. Farm bills, John, you're right, throughout history pass easily because so many states, everybody has a stake. Okay, maybe not in New York City, but upstate New York, how about dairy farmers? It's a big deal across the country. Everybody wants to be able to vote for it. When this thing started to unravel on the House floor yesterday, it was almost dead silent. Everybody thought this thing was going to pass, and the whips didn't know what was going on. People were stunned. Lots of recriminations afterward about how a $1 trillion bill went down the tubes. But here's the last thing, John. Yeah, people are really surprised because you know what's coming up? Immigration. There's going to have to be a coalition to find immigration. You heard Nancy Pelosi. If you guys can't get even close to the votes on a farm bill and you need me, that's okay. But don't blame us if you're 60 votes short. How are they going to pass immigration, which is 10 times more controversial than this?
Here's a bit of history, Todd. We just spent 4 minutes talking about the farm bill. That's a record for this program.
To great effect, yeah. I think.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend. And now, listen to a master of metaphors, hard at work.
Segregation is a cancer in the body politic which must be removed before our democratic health can be realized.
The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. working on different ways of describing a racial divide that was invisible to many Americans back in 1963.
Segregation is wrong because it is a system of adultery perpetuated by an illicit intercourse between injustice and immorality.
But the master was just warming up.
No, I hope you will allow me to say to you this afternoon that God is not interested merely in the freedom of black men and brown men and yellow men. God is interested in the freedom of the whole human race.
Those words were spoken almost exactly 50 years ago, June 23rd, 1963. The Reverend Martin Luther King was rehearsing history on something he called God's keyboard.
The Negro came to feel that he was somebody. His religion revealed to him. His religion revealed to him that God loves all of his children, and that all men are made in his image, and that figuratively speaking, every man from a base black to a treble white is significant on God's keyboard.
What you are listening to are words of Dr. King from that June 23rd speech in Detroit, Michigan, a protest rally before hundreds of thousands of people, held a few months before the famous I Have a Dream speech was delivered in Washington, D.C., on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. By the time King got to Washington, the metaphors of cancer and adultery were gone as descriptions of segregation. There was no more God's keyboard. But there in Detroit, he tried out a rhetorical flourish that would eventually be written, as King himself might have said it, on the stone tablets of history.
And so this afternoon I have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day, right down in Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to live together as brothers. I have a dream this afternoon that my four little children And my four little children will not come up in the same young days that I came up within, but they will be judged on the basis of the content of their character, not the color of their skin.
MLK's dream, battle-tested in Detroit, phrases that perfectly captured how King's aspirations for racial justice were America's original aspirations for freedom and equality.
I have a dream this afternoon that one day right here in Detroit, Negroes will be able to buy a house or rent a house anywhere that their money will carry them, and they will be able to get a job. I have a dream this evening that one day we will recognize the words of Jefferson that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I have a dream this afternoon.
Journalist and activist Tony Brown was there in Detroit on that day. He helped organize the 1963 Freedom Walk. 50 years later, Brown remembers the event as a high watermark for the city and the nation.
It was like nothing any of us had ever experienced. It was like your skin crawling on your body. When Dr. King opened his mouth and started the I Have a Dream speech, which is widely believed to be the first time it took place, which was on June 23rd, 1963, 66 days before the one that got the publicity in Washington, D.C.
Did you get the sense that he was turning a corner in his message, that he was trying out a new way of really framing the whole civil rights question by using the dream construction and some of the other metaphors in that speech?
Well, number one, aren't we all? I'm a public speaker, and I can tell you every time I make a speech, it's the first time I've ever made it, even if I've made it 100 times before. Number two, it was a stump speech, but somewhere in that speech, if you listen on some of those recordings, you hear a voice say, "Tell them about the dream, Martin," and that was Mahalia Jackson, the famous gospel singer. And at that point, he seemed to get a lift, and he seemed to get a psychic direction. So, yes, he spoke extemporaneously, which means he never gave the same speech twice. But the idea of him framing what he was talking about came across with absolute certainty. He wanted all of us to get along. It was a Rodney King speech decades before Rodney King came on the scene. He wanted all of us to share not a dream in an illusionary way, but a dream in a constructive way, where as Americans we could stop the foolishness of trying to harm one another because of the way we looked or because of our ancestry.
Tony Brown is host of Tony Brown's Journal. He coordinated the 1963 Freedom Walk Detroit. We'll leave you with this echo from that 1963 speech, forgotten today, but filled with so many hints of things to come.
I have a dream this afternoon that the brotherhood of man will become a reality in this day. With this faith, I will go out and carve a tunnel of hope through the mountain of despair. With this faith, I will go out with you and transform dark yesterdays into bright tomorrows. With this faith, we will be able to achieve this new day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing with the Negroes in the spiritual of old, "Free at last, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Barrier tips it out to Chalmers. Wade throws it up to James. The Spurs will not foul. Final seconds. What a finish. It's back-to-back titles for the Heat. The 2013 NBA Championship resides once again in Miami.
Mike Breen with the call there on ABC and ESPN. It's all about LeBron James today. What was once the Big Three is now the James Gang. The Miami Heat is LeBron's team. The NBA is LeBron's league. And today we live on planet LeBron. And what do they speak on this planet?
I work on my game a lot throughout the offseason. I put a lot of work into it. And to be able to come out here and the results happen out on the floor is the ultimate. It's the ultimate. I'm lost for words.
Lost for words. The 95-88 victory in Game 7 over the San Antonio Spurs makes a second championship out of three finals appearances for the mighty Heat and the King. And in some of the post-game talk, you could hear LeBron's gratitude to the basketball gods.
I'm LeBron James from Akron, Ohio, from the inner city. I'm not even supposed to be here. That's enough. Every night I walk into the locker room, I see a number 6 with James on the back. I'm blessed.
Joining us now, Tim Reynolds, a reporter for the Associated Press down in Miami. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is Joey Palacios, reporter for KSTX in San Antonio, Texas, home of the Spurs. Welcome to you, Joey.
Hello, thank you.
So the Spurs almost pulled this out, I have to say, but in the end, an unstoppable force, so LeBron James. Right, Joey?
Yeah, we do have to concede to Miami this time, but it was definitely a fight, you know, 1-1 going all the way into the last game of the finals.
Well, it was definitely an exciting finals. Tim Reynolds, do you think the Miami fans will stay in their seats now next year for the NBA season? They got a second championship there.
No, they won't stay until the end, but it's just a small number of them that tend to leave early. The vast majority will stay, and I expect them to sell every ticket again next season and probably at all the same demand as this season was. The vast majority stick around. There are a few, though, that will forever leave early because this is Miami.
And because the traffic is so dreadful around the stadium down there. So, Tim, let's talk a little bit about, is this a sigh of relief or a dynasty for the Heat?
I don't believe it's a dynasty yet. I do think it's a sigh of relief because this was very much a championship or bust season. I mean, and this is what they created in July 2010. They sort of brought a level of unbelievable expectation to themselves, and you know, two times in these three seasons they've lived up to it. And you know, the expectation level will be, of course, the same again next year, that it will be championship or bust for LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and Eric Spoelstra and Pat Riley.
Tim Reynolds is a reporter for the Associated Press down in Miami. Joey Palacios, let's finish with you. Talk about unbelievable expectations. The Spurs turned back the clock in these seven games of the finals.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is something that San Antonio itself has wanted for the past 6 years. The last time that we were in the finals was 2007. And we've been here four times before. This was our fifth time. And it's a new feeling because we haven't lost before, so we're kind of in this state of, well, what happens now? But I can guarantee, though, that the Spurs are ready for next season. They're going to be gearing up. The team that was on the floor last night was not the same one that was on game one of the finals, so we can guarantee that next year I think the Spurs will be at least into the playoffs, if not into the Western Conference Finals.
All right, Joey Palacios, reporter for KSTX in San Antonio, Texas, taking some solace there, even though the Spurs did not win the NBA Finals. Joey, thanks so much.
No problem.
Tickets, please.
Friday, takeaway movie day with Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer. They're here to weigh in. Rafer, of course, film critic for Newsday. Kristen, culture producer for The Takeaway. They both make up the Movie Date podcast, which you can subscribe to at moviedatepodcast.org. Welcome.
Thanks, John.
So my three-year-old sees the billboards and says, "Hey, Dad, there's Mike Wazowski. Here's Monsters University, which opens this weekend. Something of a prequel for Monsters, Inc. Here's a clip.
James B. Sullivan.
Mike Wazowski. Listen, it was quite delightful meeting you and whatever that is, but if you don't mind, I have to study my scaring.
You don't need to study scaring. You just do it.
Really? I think there's a little more to it than that. But hey, thanks for stopping by.
Let go of that! My hat!
My pig!
An irresistible cast, really a magical movie, Monsters, Inc., the first time around. That's Billy Crystal and John Goodman back for this. Kristen, what'd you think?
I thought it was delightful and fun. It really follows that kind of Revenge of the Nerds model. You have a kid going to college for the first time, realizing that maybe he doesn't quite fit in as much as he was hoping he would, teaming up with somebody who seemingly seems like his enemy at first, that's Sully, who's the big monster on campus, and Mike, who's kind of a misfit. And in the end, they have to work together, and maybe they'll become friends. Maybe they'll learn a little bit from each other.
The first one was about this sort of energy question of, do you get more energy from making kids scream or making them laugh? What's the premise this time, Rafer?
You know, what I liked about this one, and I actually like this better than the original, wow, is it concentrates more on the characters, and there's a little bit less of that power plant, scream canister, magic doorway confusion that I always thought was, yeah, a little bit tortured in the original. This is just about these two personalities developing, facing some pretty tough truths about each other, and it really works. Kristen mentioned Revenge of the Nerds. I would almost mention Paper Chase. There are some really serious moments where the film really reminds you that college is like really a place where you test your mettle and learn something about your character, and not all of it's good. And I think that's what kind of drives this one home. I thought it was really wonderful.
College, a place where one-eyed people can be friends with hairy monsters.
That's right.
Interesting.
That's right.
All right. So we earlier this, I guess, spring got a sense of Morgan Freeman trying to save the world. Now we get Brad Pitt.
I'm scared.
Connie. There's a helicopter waiting for us on the roof. Keep your eyes on Mommy and Daddy, okay?
How do we know they're coming?
They're coming.
They're coming. World War Z, zombie apocalypse. Kristen, what do you think?
Well, this is indeed a zombie apocalypse movie. We have Brad Pitt, who is recently retired from the UN. He used to be a field operative. He's sent back out into the field because of these zombies that are taking over. He has to go out and help find out where the source of the zombie virus is, how to fix things. And these
I
are fast-moving.
I want this to work, guys. I want this to work.
I do have to say, these are really scary zombies. These
All
are
right.
fast-moving, scary, terrifying zombies. And they do go... They do tap into our zombie anxieties about everything from international warfare, our international enemies, Israel, North Korea.
Wait a minute,
and
zombies,
yes.
Israel? I don't have any of that in me, but go ahead, Rafer.
You know, this has been known as Brad Pitt's troubled zombie movie for
yes,
a long time. It's
right.
been delayed, cost overruns, all this stuff. I actually think it works really, really,
really?
Well. I don't think it's a masterpiece. It doesn't bring a lot new to the zombie genre, but it's a very high-class, expensive-looking, good-looking movie. Nice to see a star like Brad Pitt in a zombie flick, and I think it really works. It's smart and fun and really enjoyable.
All right. The date movie this weekend is Before Midnight. Listen.
Well, I know you better than I know anybody else on the planet, but maybe that's
right
not saying
now,
much. What?
This is great.
Right.
You know, I feel close to you.
Yeah.
But sometimes, I don't know, I feel like you're breathing helium and I'm breathing oxygen.
What makes you say that?
See? I'm trying
come
to
on,
truly connect
myself.
And you make a joke.
The third installment of Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. How does it work, Rafer?
I was a big, big fan of the first two movies. They really hit me where I lived. I was exactly the right age for each one. I went into this with very high hopes and came out very disappointed. I think it just doesn't work. The characters don't work. It feels very lazy. I was really heartbroken by this, I have
to
say.
So there's your options. Before Midnight, World War Z, and Monsters University. Guys, have a great weekend.
Thanks, John.
Kristen Meinzer, Rafer Guzman.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International. In collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
For the children of immigrants brought to America, the right papers may be as important as the right parents.
I was brought here when I was 12.
Yeah.
I didn't have papers since I was 16. My grandparents, who are American citizens, didn't tell me. So I've been here.
By age 16, Jose Antonio Vargas probably knew more about the papers he needed to be an American citizen than he knew about his own parents.
I kind of realized we were living in two different worlds. So when I found out that I didn't have the right papers, that I was actually here in America illegally, I had to create a different system of reality in my head in which she was never a factor. I mean, we haven't seen each other in almost 20 years.
Jose created a system of reality to keep his undocumented status a secret, and he did that until 2011 when he revealed his status in a piece for the New York Times Magazine. The story of how Jose Antonio Vargas went from confused child to secret undocumented immigrant to immigration reform activist is told in his new film, Documented. The film premieres tonight at the American Film Institute's Documentary Film Festival in Washington, D.C. Jose, congratulations and welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So part of this is your story. Part of this is a broad story of the experience of what it's like to turn that corner from being a secret undocumented member of the United States community to being out on an issue that is right now being dealt with in Congress?
On an issue that I would say is, you know, the most controversial yet least understood issue in America. And I think we have the Senate bill to show for that. you know, this is a very complicated topic that I think most Americans think they know, but not really. And I say this as somebody who's I've been traveling this country now for 2 years as, again, openly undocumented traveling. I've done about 130 events in 30 states in 2 years. Ohio, Alabama, Iowa, just in terms of the exchanges with people about what it's like to be undocumented.
Some of the stories that we've explored on this program regarding immigration and the question of what happens to children who are born in the United States is this narrative of separation from parents and family. And you've experienced that personally, and you show that in the film.
That's probably what I was most afraid of about this film. You know, I can, you know, I've done Lou Dobbs and Bill O'Reilly and Michelle Malkin, and, you know, there isn't anybody in this country that I will not engage as civilly as possible when it comes to this issue. But I haven't seen my mom for 20 years this coming August. August 3rd, 1993 was when I left. And deciding to send a film crew to the Philippines to document her, you know, I had to do it for the film, but I personally, I just wasn't, I've spent more time in the past 3 months editing her on the screen than I've seen her in 20 years.
And did you go with the crew to the Philippines?
No. I can't leave. She can't come here. She's been denied a visa to come here, and I can't leave because if I leave, I won't be able to come back.
So this window in the edit room is like looking at your mother far away on the other side of the world.
You know, I mean, it's like we talk on the phone. I like a lot of immigrants, like many immigrants, I've been sending remittances to support her and my siblings, one sibling that I haven't even met. So that's been the communication. But, you know, like, how do you explain 20 years? I don't know how to explain that. And I couldn't even Skype with her just because, it's just too difficult. And I think facing that and filming that and documenting that was probably for me the hardest thing.
But you're not saying that your mom is more intimidating than Lou Dobbs. It's just an emotional experience for you.
Well, I mean, I don't know about intimidating. But no, I mean, I think it's just so much that has been lost in terms of what I gained and what I lost and what she lost. It's so important that we remember just a broken immigration system means broken families. It means broken lives. That's what it means. It's not only about Republican or Democrat or Marco Rubio running for president or the border security provisions in this bill. This is way broader and bigger than that.
Well, in this conversation with your mother, and yes, there is a broken immigration system in the United States, but does she bear some responsibility for this separation in that this dream of America turns out so differently? And, you know, you've lost something that you can never get back.
Well, there isn't, I mean, this is not, I think this is bigger than the whole idea of, like, who's to blame and why she did what she did. I mean, look, when I was younger, came here when I was 12, discovered when I was 16 that I was here illegally, I was very, very resentful. I didn't understand why my mother did what she did. I didn't understand why my grandparents, my mother's parents, didn't explain to me that they thought I was just going to get here and, you know, work under the table jobs and marry a woman and get a green card that way, which of course didn't work out because I'm gay and I wasn't about to lie about being gay and undocumented at the same time. I was very resentful towards my family. It took me a while. I mean, I guess that's what immaturity is. It took me a while to realize why they did what they did, which is really interesting because we have a lot of politicians in this country, Republican or Democrat, who say, oh, they're for the DREAM Act. You know, they're for providing a path to citizenship for undocumented youth. And they should not be blamed for the sins of the parents. Well, what is the sin of the parent? You know, my mother wanted to give me a better life. It was as simple as that. I mean, of course, it's painful. I cannot even, you know, it wasn't until I saw her on screen looking directly at the camera as if she's like talking to me. I don't think it wasn't until then that I realized what she lost.
And what you lost.
And what I lost. And, but you know, but this is the painful stuff. This is the real painful stuff. And I didn't want it to be this self-serving, narcissistic, you know, exercise. And I mean, as a filmmaker, I wanted, of course, to be as raw and as real as possible. But how do you give her dignity, you know, on film? And so that, I mean, for me, that was the challenge.
Well, there's so much there. The film is documented. Jose Antonio Vargas is the writer and director. The film premieres tonight in Washington.
Yes.
All right.
Please find us, documented.us, documented.us.
Jose Antonio Vargas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, as the number of refugees grows worldwide, an unexpected partnership to build more effective shelters in camps for the displaced. We asked you, if you suddenly had to leave your home, what would you take with you? Mike from Barnstable, Mass., right? My wife, my beagle, my dog tags, my wallet, my wedding ring. I've lived in some pretty rotten situations. Don't need much else. We'd love to hear your story, your thoughts. Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. We end this week and this hour noting what we learned at the beginning of the program. The worst refugee crisis in 20 years, 45 million people living in places they never planned to live. Refugees displaced by war, politics, poverty, and climate change. The transition from citizen to refugee can be sudden, but could there be more planning devoted to where people end up when they are displaced? We were all reminded at the beginning of this hour that it is a minority of refugees who live in the classic refugee camps that we've seen. Most try to get by in shelters within existing cities. Well, the IKEA Foundation, the philanthropic wing of the retailer, thinks this could be an opportunity, not for its furniture business, but to use its expertise in developing low-cost design solutions for consumers to do the same for displaced people. In partnership with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, IKEA is rolling out a new easy-to-transport, durable, and easy-to-assemble lodging solution for refugees. With us now is Greg Hodgen. He's the founder of Peace Building Solution, which also aims to produce better refugee community design and management approaches. Greg, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here, John.
This application of design to the question of displaced people has been going on for a while. What are the kinds of needs that you're beginning to address, and how is design helping to improve the lot of displaced persons?
Well, that's a good question, John. The issue that we actually see is the fact that a lot of refugees are in a more protracted scenario. Most people think that refugees go to a camp or they're there for a couple of years and they go home again, and that's just simply not the case anymore. Especially after the end of the Cold War, the fact of the matter is that a lot of these refugees are stuck in these camps for a long time. We're talking on the average of 7 to 8 years, sometimes more. There's a camp in Kenya right now that actually has 500,000 refugees living there, and most of them have been there since the mid-1990s. So the fact of the matter is that all of these issues, all of these problems that you see become compounded over time. A lot of these people become hopeless. They feel like they're not going anywhere. They feel that no one's taking care of them. They feel like they're only getting the basic needs taken care of. They'll get their food taken care of and their water and things of that nature, but that will save your life, but it doesn't really prepare you for the future. So what we're looking to do is actually to take a more long-term holistic approach to engage in not just the shelters, the water, the sanitation, the bread and butter, if you will, but also education, healthcare, adult employment opportunities so that people can get back up on their feet and leave and don't have to come back again.
Can you actually design a community or anticipate a community that has all those features, including education and employment?
Yes and no. You can lay out the bread and butter, yes, but one of the things that you have to do is you must work with the local populations in question. And a lot of people think that there's this one-size-fits-all approach to refugee communities, and there's simply not. One of the things that we usually do before we go out into the field is we actually do research with the community itself and ask them if they actually want us to help them. Just because you have this wonderful new technology that can do whatever you want it to do doesn't mean the local population is going to actually accept it. So you have to make sure that you work with the people on the ground in question to ensure that they want you there, first of all. Secondly, that you're giving them what they actually want and what they actually need. Because just because we come in with the resources doesn't mean that we know everything about what's going on. In fact, more often than not, I've heard from experts in the field, and I've seen it myself, everyone walks in with this beautiful, well-executed plan, and they walk into the field, and they take the book and throw half of it away because some of it just simply doesn't work. Mm. There are lessons you can learn, but you have to take it as each individual circumstance is a new thing to do, a new issue, a new community to work with.
How does design help the majority of displaced persons who actually find their own ways in existing cities. They aren't actually going to camps at all, or the makeshift facilities that the United Nations puts up there. They're trying to find a place in you know, some neighborhood in an existing city.
What they usually do is that when it comes to design perspective, that you can't help with the shelters, but you can help with finding them employment. You can help them finding education. You can get them food. You can get them ration cards, things of that nature. Because when it comes to urban situations especially, the fact of the matter is that they do sometimes have shelter. One of the big ones is actually in Malaysia. The Rohingya people who live in Malaysia at this point in time, a large number of them, very persecuted minority, most of them are urban refugees. And they'll pack themselves into apartments that have 30, 40 people at a time because they have nowhere else to go and the government doesn't want them to go anywhere else. So when it comes to those situations, design isn't as useful. It's more of the execution, the implementation of other projects. When you're building camps out in the field, though, when you're building communities out in the field, that's when you can really sit down and design what you really want to go with, where you really want to go, where do you put the school, where does the community want the school, where does the community want the clinic, where does the community want the church, things of that nature. When it comes to urban refugees, it's a bit more difficult, and it's a bit more taxing on the organizations in question.
In the communities that you're talking about, is it always a grid where everything's laid out in a line? How do the spaces between the tents or shelters, if this IKEA thing takes off, how do those spaces become roads and you know, wayfinding for people as this becomes a real community?
The thing is that the community becomes organic over time. As people grow and as the community grows, people start treating certain shelters in certain places. A lot of my work I've actually done in Haiti, and Haiti is an internally displaced person scenario. There are 320,000 internally displaced persons still in Haiti after the earthquake, and you see the camps grow organically. You see this shelter is not a place that you live. This is the cooking shelter. This is where we do all the cooking at, and we that's where we do that. And then this shelter is the clinic, and then this shelter is the school. And the community just kind of grows organically. They grow with respect to that, and they actually designate where they want things to go. And when you allow them to do that, they accept it a lot more, and they appreciate what you're doing a lot more as well. So it really does become an organic growth. This road all of a sudden becomes a road, or this one's not a road, and this is a runoff place, or we put the latrines here, so we'll put the school on the other side of the latrines, or something to that effect. So it becomes a very organic growth over time, depending on how long the refugees or the IDPs are actually staying.
What about kids? Places for kids, playgrounds, toys, just leisure activity outside of schools?
That's actually one of the things that Peacebuilding Solutions is actually looking to address, and we've actually found a fascinating new technology that we're very excited to actually talk to the NGO. They're working on, and I'm not making this up, this is absolutely amazing, they're actually working on a soccer ball that kids can kick around. So, you know, you give them a soccer field and they kick it around, and inside the soccer ball is a power source that they charge while they're kicking it. So at night, you can take the power source out of the soccer ball and charge a cell phone or charge a pump or maybe a light at night or something to that effect. So in essence, while the kids are playing, you can actually take this new technology and recharge things down the road, which is absolutely fascinating. But the most important thing for kids, and this is universal everywhere, no matter where you go, is you got to keep them in school. When you see kids going through the slums, or you see kids in these refugee communities and they're not in the schools, they're not learning anything. And most importantly, especially when they get to middle school age, 10, 12, 13, they start joining gangs, they start getting in trouble. That leads to crime, mm-hmm. That leads to increased crime. By putting them in school and by keeping them in school, by making sure that you have the school program running, you not only take care of the kids present, but you also allow this culture and that society to build its future as well.
Using design to make camps into actual communities. Greg Hodgson,
exactly,
is founder of Peacebuilding Solutions, which aims to build better refugee communities through design and management approach. If you had to leave home tomorrow, what would you take with you, Greg?
A lot of money. a lot of money, and probably, I hate to say it, but I'd probably take myself and my laptop because it's got a bunch of stuff on it. And to be honest, in the field, you could easily sell that stuff for a lot of money as well. Money is one of the most important things to take.
That's Greg's idea. What would you take if you had to leave tomorrow? 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend, folks. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.